So my colleague Fiona Schmiegel could not be here. I've co-authored the presentation with her, but she has put this together. And it allows me an opportunity to delve into a case study, which I'm happy to say the recovery strategy has been mostly a very scientifically grounded document. It's been an interesting journey. I've been involved with it as well. And so it's our pleasure to talk about this as a case study with a very, very challenging species in Canada. So just for everybody to get on where we are, we're talking about forest-dwelling caribou. There are many different kinds of caribou, one species, but many different ecotypes in Canada. And we're talking about the one that is distributed within the boreal forest. This is different from those in Arctic and barren ground areas, and even in mountain areas of Western Canada. This is only in Canada. It's endemic to Canada, this particular ecotype. It did once range as far south as New England, Minnesota states, and into further west from that. And so it's lost about 50% of its range, and many populations are declining, particularly in Western Canada and at the southern edge of the distribution. The journey towards developing a recovery strategy, which was just finalized in 2012, was arduous. This species was assessed as threatened prior to the act coming into force in 2003, and it was one of those species that was listed automatically when the act came into force, but it was a long time before it received a recovery strategy. But that intervening period was actually not without a lot of work, there were drafts that were produced before that, but for various reasons that I won't go into, they did not emerge into the public light. The recovery goal is to maintain self-sustaining local populations in all caribou ranges throughout the current distribution. It's not the historic distribution. This has been a steadfast recovery goal, but there have been various times where there have been attempts to make it less than that. But what is important to note here is that the final recovery strategy did actually uphold that goal. There has been a scientific review of critical habitat that was undertaken in the intervening years before to inform the recovery strategy. This is not a usual thing for species at risk in Canada, but this is a species, which I didn't mention before, that has great vulnerability to land use changes, and so is at the forefront. It's on our Canadian quarter. It's at the forefront of a lot of discussions about natural resource development in the north because caribou do so poorly under these frameworks. So there's a lot of attention to this species, and so for this reason there was this investment in the scientific review for critical habitat. There were two phases to this assessment, and that helped inform and particularly the critical habitat designation in the recovery strategy. From that assessment, 51 local population ranges were identified across Canada. As you can see, they're very variable in size, in condition. And they're also identified by each jurisdiction or each province. So that's why some of the artificial boundaries at the provincial lines. The environmental conditions vary much, but they have a common need for large undisturbed areas of conifer-dominated forest, and that provides a lot of difficulty for populations in the present context. The major threat is habitat loss. That's the ultimate threat. The proximate cause often is through predation, because what happens when forest gets changed over large scales into more early successional habitats, this provides a lot of opportunities for other ungulates like moose and deer to invade these areas. And then that enhances predator populations who are not necessarily after caribou, but the few caribou that there are that space away as a predator strategy are made quite vulnerable by this context. And so we'll have precipitous declines that happen where the primary mortality factor is actually wolves, and artificially high wolf densities will follow ungulate densities that have increased in this area as well. The critical habitat exercise actually developed a very sound empirical relationship, a linear relationship that's in the left-hand bar there between amount of disturbance in a population range and the actual recruitment or the population the population condition. So meaning that the more habitat disturbance there is, that the less likelihood there is of the species of population sustaining itself. And so if you look in the left-hand bar there, this is just a linear relationship. It doesn't have an obvious threshold. And there's a little bit of variability around that in terms of the populations that were studied. But the R-squared was still quite high and highly significant. It was about 80%. And so this has led to a kind of a schematic in terms of looking at this continuum in terms of the disturbance of within caribou ranges as a function of population condition relative to the recovery goal, that really the more habitat disturbance you have, the less likelihood of the population being self-sustaining. But obviously, because there isn't a particular drop-off point, you have a zone of uncertainty where you really cannot say for certain whether or not that population is going to be sustaining or not. And that is that gray area of uncertainty. The recovery strategy actually expresses a clear policy statement relative to the risk and the likelihood of achieving the recovery strategy. And it says that the recovery strategy has identified 65% undisturbed habitat in the range as a disturbance management threshold. And it relates this to the critical habitat work that we've been doing in saying that that means that it has about a 60% chance of achieving the goal. And so by putting that management threshold in there, it has made a management decision and of the amount of risk that it would be willing to take and what would be called sustainable. And this management threshold is not an ecological transition point, as I explained, but it's a social choice that's informed by science that's within this recovery strategy. And as you know, we're talking about a 65% undisturbed habitat still gives you by some measures, a fairly important chance that that population will not be able to sustain itself. And so that is a bit of a gamble. And if we apply this towards critical habitat definition, which was done, and this was a very different way of doing it, that you were actually going to use the population range as the unit by which you would identify critical habitat. And critical habitat means that you need to restore habitat that is underneath that 65% management threshold and that you need to actually maintain or make sure that you don't exceed the 65% threshold for those that are in relatively good shape. And this schematic here, there's quite a few other that we don't have time to look into, but this schematic here really differentiates the populations in purple, which are in trouble and that really require restoration. Their ranges have exceeded the threshold that was identified in the recovery strategy. And indeed, all of these populations are in some state of decline or in some state of risk, even if we don't know what's actually happening at the population level. And that differentiates it from the other green ones, where they're in relatively good shape for the time being, but some of them are actually teetering around that 65% threshold. And the recovery strategy differentiates those two groups in a nutshell. There are a number of strengths to this approach, and it's quite unique, and it was a fight to get there. In the first, it addresses the challenge of managing a wide-ranging at-risk species with limited population information. So we were able to, with those populations that have good population information, to be able to derive relationships that were likely to be occurring for those where population information was not very good, and to be able to assess the risk based on how much disturbance is happening in the range. It also established an appropriate scale, that population range, for managing. And this was a very difficult conversation to have, particularly with legal staff advising the federal government, who were used to taking small pieces of area and saying this is critical habitat or not, this is important for the species or not. What this did is elevate it to the population level and say it's not about any piece of geography, it's about the condition of the range at any given point of time, and so that it must be maintained at a disturbance level that does not exceed a threshold. That threshold, however, is decided by management, and the management is in light of what we are decide is going to be an appropriate level of risk. It's not necessarily the risk that I would be willing to take, but it is the risk that was decided by management. That scale is very important, and it is different and really a strength of the approach. It also, by virtue of being able to do that, it facilitates consideration of cumulative effects. In the end of the day, with habitat loss being the ultimate driver of caribou population condition, it really is about cumulative effects. It's about the accumulation of roads, habitat disturbance, and all of these features that are happening by various agents in one range. And so being able to keep your eye on the population level in terms of how that disturbance accumulates over time is really critical, and that's what the recovery strategy is able to do it. It also clearly distinguishes a scientific basis for decision making from a social choice and what risk is being able to take. It explicitly acknowledges uncertainty and risk, and it allows for regional variation. I didn't go into that, but knowing that those populations that formed the relationship, that empirical relationship, had exhibited variability, then we know that there is going to be some kind of difference in terms of where that magic threshold is from one range to the other. And the recovery strategy does allow for more work to be done on that regional variation. But there are multiple challenges. And with many things, an interestingly designed strategy that then comes into action planning runs headlong into the winds of the realities of implementation. And as I mentioned previously, the provinces are primarily responsible for this, for implementing the plans. And while they were at the table during the formulation of the recovery strategy, it is the blueprint, and it is not it is still the provinces that are responsible. And the problem is that it is a probabilistic approach. We're talking about a continuum of risk, not a really hard and fast boundary where things are going to go awry. And what happens in reality is that everybody's looking at that 65% and saying, let's manage up to that. And that's going to be what we're allowed to do. But that variability and the huge risk that's around that zone of uncertainty is lost in that conversation. And so even though uncertainty and risk are embraced in the recovery strategy, when push comes to shove, they're not explicitly dealt with when it comes to implementation. The language even says that. We're talking about a minimum of 65%. And so, people are going to go to town with that when it comes to approving development. And there's time lags and all these kinds of difficult things that really come to play. And then how well are we monitoring caribou as we're introducing new disturbance? Because the weird thing about this is that this is a species that was listed also on a criterion because of decline, but yet we're allowing new development into some parts of its range. And so that's kind of a counterintuitive, because you should be really actually in a conserving state of mind, but we're, by virtue of this framework, we're actually continuing development up to a limit which we now feel informed by, and that has its challenges. And so due to that variability in caribou that informed the population disturbance relationship, we've got about the recovery strategy selected a management threshold that still allows for 60% probability of achieving the recovery goal. So only 60%. So there's a real risk that you could satisfy the recovery criteria and fail to meet the objective. And so if you look at sort of the lower boundaries, there's a risk attached to this, because the lower boundary of the 90% prediction interval for 65% undisturbed habitat gives you a 30% probability of self-sustaining population. But on the other hand, you've got a lot of opportunities in the above should you choose to accept it, and you is obviously this is most of these decisions are at the provincial level, where you can use the management. I mean, you can use the particular information and knowledge about what's happening with caribou in those areas to be able to inform really where you are on that threshold in reality, and so there is this risk and opportunity dimension to it, and we'll see how it happens. I'll be here in a few years to tell you. So, of the means and ends and the path in between. The National Recovery Strategy is built on a scientific foundation. It can't be said to be an entirely scientific document, but it's built on a scientific foundation. And this document embraced uncertainty and it encouraged adaptation. But the strategy itself is still a bit institutionally inert, and that will be solidified by implementation, particularly as it's being handed off to the provinces. And in order to address both those limitations in the availability of population data, which in some places is not ongoing, and an incredibly dynamic environment in which this wide-ranging species occurs, it was a proxy of a recovery goal that was actually used. And so management of range-level disturbance is a means to an end as a result. And we really need, but we don't necessarily have yet, an integrated and proactive approach. The feds can provide a blueprint, and they do have a hammer in the act, which is called the safety net, which means that if the provinces aren't living up to their obligations, the federal government can come down. It has not happened yet in 10 years, but it could happen, and it should happen. And that is a role of the recovery strategy. And so uncertainty above and beyond, of which there's huge amounts, does warrant a precautionary approach. And that's where I'll end. Thank you very much.